And welcome to another installation of SciFlix here at Tune FM. I'm your host, Bridget Glover, and in case you don't know, SciFlix is a collaboration between Belgrave Cinema, Tune FM, and UNE Life here in Armidale, where we get to watch science-themed films on the big screen and we get to hear from an expert or multiple experts afterwards and do a Q&A. The next film we have coming up will be the 1996 film From Dusk Till Dawn, and that will be on the 2nd of May at 6 p.m. sharp. Tickets are already up on Belgrave, which is cool. And I'm really excited for this one. This film is crazy. Like, it's been a while since I watched it. It's wild. We've got our experts here today, Dr. Zen Senzi?
Chenzi.
And PhD candidate Ruby Demel?
Demel.
Yes, to answer some of my bat-related queries ahead of the film event in a couple of weeks. Thanks so much for joining me, guys. Really cool to have you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having us, Richard.
No problem. Okay, I'm going to start with you, Dr. Zen. I know a little bit about you thanks to trusty Google. I had to do some digging ahead of this. But would you mind telling, you know, the listener who you are and a little bit about your work?
Sure. As Bridget says, my name is Zenon Chenzi, and I'm a lecturer here at UNE focusing on physiology and vertebrates and stuff like that, and trusty Google, you know, don't always trust Google, but so I've been working on bats since nearly 14 years now. So I've kind of traveled the world.
Yeah.
Trying to catch bats in forests and caves and stuff like that. So
that's so cool.
Yeah, I started in a place called Canada, where I'm sure your listeners can tell that's where my outrageous accent is coming from.
Sure.
Started looking at the little parasites that were on bats in the beginning, so fleas and mites and stuff like that. Then transitioned over to how do these bats hibernate in the coldest part of their range, where these bats might go into a cave and then hang out for the entire winter, which might be 7 months of the year, and they're able to do that without coming out of the cave on 2 grams of stored fat.
That's amazing.
So that started the old physiology train starting, and from there I went to New Zealand, worked on an endangered bat over there called the lesser short-tailed bat. Then there was a foray in South Africa and Belize and Poland, and here I am now. So
that's wild. Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm still caught up on the 7 months just chilling out in the cave. That's
very chilly.
That's amazing. That's so cool. Ruby, Google did not deliver as much on you. I am aware that you went on a trip to Sturt Desert. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
But could you tell us a little bit about, you know, you and your PhD project?
Sure. So as my accent probably gives me away, I'm not from here. I'm from Sri Lanka originally. So I started off actually studying elephants. And then, so from elephants, I transitioned to European hedgehogs in the UK, and haven't done a lot of bat-related work before I came here, just a couple of surveys back home. But here I am in Australia studying the lesser long-eared bat, which is actually the commonest insectivorous bat here in Australia.
Really?
So my PhD project basically looks at how these bats deal with the heat.
Yes.
You know, what sort of mechanisms they have in order to, you know, beat the heat, you know, and survive these heat waves. So that's the big focus of my PhD.
Amazing.
And yes, as you said, I did travel to Sturt National Park last year, did a bit of field work there. And then again last year, we were actually in Canada looking at Canadian hot bats.
Google didn't tell me that. Okay, interesting. Right, so what was going on over there?
So a similar project to what we are conducting here, you know, we are looking at, so, you know, people don't essentially, you know, connect Canada with heat, usually,
right,
because, you know,
I'm thinking cold, I'm thinking snow.
There you go, there you go. But, you know, there are parts of Canada that get quite hot.
Yes.
So we wanted to see how those bats, you know, again, deal with the heat. So we went to Lillooet, all thanks to Zenon here. So a bunch of us were there for about 2.5 months looking at how those bats, you know, combat the heat. And so that was last year. And then again this year, we were all in South Australia for 3 months in the desert again, looking at hot bats in South Australia. So, yeah.
Lovely. And like, what are you finding? Like, what are their mechanisms?
Oh, yeah. So,
if you know anything yet.
Sure. So, when we look at the hot bats of, say, Sturt, mm-hmm. we see that, you know, in desert environment, water is a precious sort of commodity.
Sure.
You know, it's not something they have in abundance. So they need to conserve water,
yeah.
you know, more than anything else. So if they try to cool themselves down by using water from the outset, they run out of water. So yes. they run the risk of dehydration.
Wow.
So then they have to now figure out a way of, you know, dealing with the heat without using much water. So what they do is they actually hold off on the use of water until it gets very, very hot,
mm-hmm.
you know, rather than starting to use water from the outset. So
how hot is very hot, Ruby?
That's
good question.
Yes. So what we found was that the female bats from Sturt National Park, they don't start using water until it gets to around 42.5 degrees Celsius.
Oh my gosh.
And to the best of our knowledge, that is the highest such point that's ever been recorded for any bat species
wow.
in the world.
Really?
So, very exciting.
That's unreal. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that is really bloody hot. That's crazy.
It's super hot. And, you know, you have to think, unlike other mammals, because these things are nocturnal, right? So if you're diurnal, you can go and find some shade or, you know, go and have a drink of water. But because bats are nocturnal, right, they have to kind of grin and bear it during the hottest part of the day in a tiny little tree roost or underneath some bark. So they need to be really tough. And
yeah.
one of the things that Ruby has found is that these bats will allow their body temperature to get up to 44 degrees Celsius.
God, so now, amazing.
Yeah, oh so you gosh. And I are running at 37.
Right.
Right. We go two yeah. degrees higher than that, we have a stroke, we die.
Yes.
But these animals that are, you know, how big are these bats, Ruby?
So anything from 6 to 9 grams.
Yeah.
So they're tiny.
So a tiny little 9 gram animal just lets
wow.
its body temperature go up, up, up. And yep. by doing that, it means that it doesn't have to rely on panting or, you know, saliva spreading on its wings.
Yeah.
And so that's the mechanism by which they can conserve that water.
That is mind-blowing. That's crazy. How do you... Oh, I've got so many stupid questions. In case the listener can't tell, I'm not a scientist. I'm a film PhD candidate. So I've got silly questions, but bear with me. I want to know how you, like, record their heat. Like, how do you... What are you doing in there that's... Like, what kind of measurements are you able to take? What's the instruments?
That's a good question. Do you want to answer that one, Ruby, or do you want me to?
Sure. I'll have a go at it.
Sure.
So what we do is, so the experiment that we use is called respirometry.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where you have the animal in a controlled environment,
yep.
and then you can record real time. So we know that when we breathe in oxygen,
mm-hmm.
and then we exhale carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
So those two measurements, so we can tell real time how much oxygen this 8 gram bat is breathing in,
mm-hmm.
how much carbon dioxide it's exhaling. And we can also tell how much water it's expending, how much water it's putting out of its body to cool itself down. All of this in real time. And as you can imagine, you know, when you're talking about an 8 gram animal, you're talking about minute amounts of air and water that's been, you know, passed through.
Yeah.
So these are very, very sensitive instruments that we use.
Yeah,
so they're very, very highly calibrated and they're very precise.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
And for the listener at home, to give you an idea of what that might look like, this very precise instrument, although the measurement tools are very precise, we oftentimes will use things like pickle jars.
Sure.
And so you can get a pickle jar effectively, and it's airtight, and
yep.
then you've got two tubes basically. One tube supplies air from the environment,
mm-hmm.
and the other tube supplies to the instruments the air that's been exchanged with that animal. So
right.
imagine a pickle jar with
yep.
two tubes,
yep.
you're starting respirometry.
Whoa. Awesome. Okay. That's amazing. All right. Well, I want to know, just going way back, you know, how did you sort of decide to come to UNE? Like, you know, was it a particular like PhD project that brought you here, or like, did you know people? How did you both come to be here?
Well, I'll take you back to the year 2020.
Oh, so long ago.
I know. I was doing my postdoc in South Africa, so I was in a place called KwaZulu-Natal on the west coast. So I was living in a rainforest at the time, catching birds, and I was applying for lecturing gigs.
Yeah.
I got an interview here at UNE. I flew out. I got back to South Africa, and 36 hours later, all the borders shut. I was told I got the job, but all the borders shut. Round about that time, Ruvi reached out to me.
Right.
And then we basically both kind of waited in our respective countries for 26 months until the borders opened up so we start here. Yeah.
Whoa. Okay. Yeah. I wasn't expecting it to be like mid-COVID. That's rough. That is rough. But yeah, 26 months. Okay. So you've not been here that long?
Nah. So I guess both of us will like July is our anniversary, Ruvi. Is that right?
I'd say so.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
That's exciting.
Yeah. So
cool.
It'll be 2 years in July.
Okay. Nice. All right. So, as I said, I'm not an expert. I did some reading about bats, found out they're like really, really cool and special and cute, but also quite important in the same way that bees are important. I didn't know this.
Sure.
But they're pollinators.
Yeah.
What's going on here? I didn't know that. Why don't we know that? Like just the regular layperson like me.
Okay.
How does that work?
I'll take this one, Ruvi. okay, so some bats are indeed pollinators. Mm-hmm. So for you and the listeners at home, if you're a fan of mangoes,
yes,
then you can thank bats.
Really?
So yeah, so bats are pollinators of the mango, their flowers. And then for your listeners who are of age, if you're a fan of tequila,
sure,
you also can thank bats for that. So there's a bat... the name escapes me now. I think it's a long-tongued bat, but it pollinates the flowers of the agave cactus. And so these flowers, you imagine the Sonoran Desert, you know, there's all of these cactuses and their flowers bloom only at night. And then these bats come in, they drink the nectar, they get covered in pollen, and then they move on to the next cactus. And so without bats, we don't have tequila or mangoes, amongst other things as well.
If I may jump in, so that's, you know, one very important facet of, say, agriculture, as Zenon spoke, the other being that, you know, you need to control the pests.
Yes,
you know,
right.
That's
pest control,
you know,
yeah.
So when it comes to that part, you know, again, bats are absolutely important because, you know, insectivorous bats, they can practically eat nearly their body weight in insects per night. So you're talking about a massive amount of pest insects that are being taken out of these agricultural lands by these bats. And if you convert that into money, like, you know, tangible values, we're talking about nearly $64 million worth of pest control just in the Australian cotton industry. Not blueberries,
goodness.
Not the vineyards, just in cotton. So we're talking about millions of dollars that's being saved in terms of pest control by these bats. So, you know, agriculture as a whole has a lot to be thankful for, the bats.
Yeah, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you were doing something at wineries?
Yeah, yeah.
Something to do with pest control?
No, that's right.
Yep.
Dr. Heidi Kolkert and I, who's also here at UNE, we started the Bats and Wine Initiative, and that's basically we had two fantastic honor students last year, Kate Rankin and Kat Stewart, who were looking at vineyards here in New England. And we found that indeed there are bats in vineyards, and not only that, but they are consuming agricultural pests.
Wow.
The neat thing about that, of course, is that if you can come to a grower and say, hey, look, if you invest in habitat protection or habitat enhancement, if you can put up artificial roosts for these bats, you can potentially increase the amount of bats that are in your vineyard or wherever you might have.
Okay.
And effectively, potentially reduce the amount of chemical pesticides. So in that sense, you know, you're protecting ecosystems, you're protecting species, and you're reducing chemical runoff. So it's kind of
a
win-win in that sense. Yeah.
Oh, that's so exciting. Yeah.
So that's a neat thing that insectivorous bats definitely have for agriculture.
Yeah, they're doing all sorts of stuff.
Well, there's nearly 1,500 species of bat. in the world. So there's about 6,000 species of mammal, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Around 1,500 of that are bats. So it's like 20% of mammal species are bats.
That's
so
insane.
They're kind of everywhere. They've got, you know, bats that are up to 1.4 kilograms. So those are some of the larger flying foxes. And then you've got bats that are down to, you know, 3 grams.
Yes, yes. So. Yeah, I feel like I've definitely come into contact with one in my house.
Okay, you're not alone in that.
Previously, I lived out in Black Mountain, and I lived in this beautiful big old house. And yeah, I had one, and it was just super cute. I didn't know what to do with it, but yeah, it was fun. And I'm sure it was doing lots of important stuff because, yeah, it was around the time, obviously, I assume they don't have anything to do with the mice, but there were like lots of insects and all sorts of stuff going on at that time. So I appreciate it. Okay, so moving on to the film. When I was obviously first coming up with, Syflix events and thinking about bats. I had a few films come to mind. I obviously had Batman, very straightforward. But honestly, a lot of the times, you know, the bat films are using this idea of vampires that transform into bats. And this is because of the vampire bat species, which I didn't know much about. I've read some cool things. I've read that they're unselfish, which is an interesting way to put it, and that their saliva is being used to develop a medication called Draculin.
Yeah, so Draculin is one of the proteins inside of their saliva.
Yeah.
So that was named because scientists are funny.
Right. I love it.
What a great idea. Let's call it Draculin. But yeah, it's being used for blood clot.
Yes.
Treatments. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was amazing. However, I also read that they can drink an animal's blood for like 30 minutes before the animal wakes up. So that's terrifying.
If you're a cow, it's definitely so long.
But yeah, I'd like to know what you guys think about this trope. Like, you know, do they deserve the bad rap? Are they just cute little things that are just trying to live their lives? Do they deserve to be, you know, put into films this way? What do you reckon?
Well, let me start off, Ruby.
Sure.
So I've worked with vampire bats. So in Belize, I've caught them. They're really, really neat. You allude to them being unselfish. So we also call that altruistic.
Yeah.
So it's hard to be an animal that feeds on blood.
Mm.
So remember we were talking about, you know, there's 1,500 species of bat.
Yeah.
Only 3 of them feed on blood.
Right.
And even if you look at animals that have vertebrae, like vertebrates, it's basically only the vampire bats. Blood's not a good nutritional food item, right?
Yep.
So there's 3 species. There's a hairy-legged, a white-winged, and then a common vampire bat. They all drink blood, and they all evolved from other phylostomid bats, which is a bat that imagine their nose kind of looks like a leaf.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
but those bats eat insects and some of them eat frogs, some of them eat fruit, and then these 3 bats over millions and millions of years have adapted to eat blood. Now, when we talk about them being unselfish, they will, what's the best term? They will regurgitate blood meals for their friends.
Yes. Didn't get enough.
That's right. Yeah. So maybe that cow that they were trying to feed on woke up and shook it off.
Right.
And these animals can only really go 2 nights without feeding. And so they'll come to their friends. This is all done by a guy named Jerry Carter in the United States.
Okay.
And they'll beg. They'll vocalize. They'll kind of nudge. But they won't harass.
Oh.
And, you know, it's also one of the neat things is when they regurgitate. So, hey, you need some help.
Yeah.
Okay, Bridget, here. Oh, you didn't have a good meal. Let me just come. I'll just throw up some blood in your mouth. Okay.
So sweet of you.
You're welcome. And it's not only they don't do that just for, you know, their sons and daughters. They don't do it for their cousins all the time. It's friendship. So one of the ways that science looks at the evolution of friendship is through these vampire bats. It's really neat. They've got cheater detection, so they know. Hey, man, I threw up in your mouth. But you haven't thrown up in my mouth in a while when I need it. So then they'll stop. And these friendships that they form are dynamic. Right?
Whoa.
So that is a neat thing.
That's so neat.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. All right. So, like, they know, you know, you've not helped me out in a while. So you can go find another friend. I'm going to go and help this person out over here. Yeah, wow.
What else is neat about vampire bats, Ruby? What do you reckon?
Yeah, I mean, they've got all these cool adaptations because, you know, you're talking about a bat that needs to drink blood from a rather large animal, right? So they can't just, you know, do this ad hoc. So they need to first hone in on a particular target per se. So they need to be able to identify between, you know, animals that are asleep and animals that are awake.
Yes.
Because you don't want to try and feed off an animal that's awake. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if you're a massive cow and you're, you know, trying to shake this bat off, and these bats actually have to crawl to their target.
Mm.
So you don't want to be stepped on by a awake cow.
Definitely not.
Right? Yeah, smart. Okay.
So one of the neat things that they found was that these bats can actually identify between, you know, animals that are awake and asleep by listening to how they breathe. And they're so good at it that they can actually identify the pattern of breathing of certain individuals when they're asleep. So they can see, oh, this cow, I know this cow. You know, I've fed from this cow because I recognize its pattern of breathing when it's asleep.
That is amazing.
The other neat thing is, so you're thinking, so for the listeners at home, vampire bats, by and large, are feeding on cattle. Right? And that's because humans have come in, they've, you know, destroyed a bunch of their ecosystem, and they brought in a whole bunch of cows. And so one of the animals that does really well are these vampire bats. Now, they range all the way down to Argentina. There's really cool footage of them feeding on penguins and birds and stuff like that. But humans are definitely not one of their preferred targets. So now imagine you're a vampire bat. You found your sleeping cow. You can tell because of its breathing patterns that it's asleep. The next thing they do is their nose is really, really flat up against. It's not pointed at all. And with their nose, they've got thermoreceptors, and they can basically sense the heat of the animal's body and find, if you look at, you know, your hands, you've got exposed veins that are closer to the surface. They can detect where those veins are because they're warmer. And then what they have to do is only make a small little incision on the external vein and then be able to start lapping up the blood. So you don't want to necessarily, you know, you want to be in and out quickly. So if you can identify where the vein is, that's the easiest way to get your blood meal. And then, as you say, you know, they might be feeding for 30 minutes. Okay. But like I said before, there's not a whole lot of nutrition in blood. And so how do you, if you're just feeding on blood for 30 minutes, where does the vast majority of that blood go? If you got to fly away and you've got a stomach full of blood, it's going to be pretty difficult. So basically what they start doing is, as soon as they start feeding, they start urinating. And so the whole, you know, sexy trope of vampires coming in and feeding, that vampire would probably just be peeing.
Got to make room.
So their whole digestive system works as a sieve. And so all of the red blood cells and the plasma, they keep that. And then the rest of the water, they just excrete.
And I read as well that, like, it's not like a bite. It's like they're making scratches or whatever. Is that, like, how
so
does
it
that
is,
work?
It's a bite. It's like, so it's like three, it's a tiny, tiny little pinprick that they make, okay? Teeny tiny, but because there's so so many anticoagulants in their saliva, that tiny little prick, the blood just starts flowing. They've got grooves in their mouth that funnel the blood into their mouth. They basically put their face flat up against the animal and just, they're not sucking, they're just, it's just flowing into their mouth.
Wow, they're so clever.
There's crazy stories about natural history museums who have skulls of vampire bats from when they were first discovered. So, you know, Aztec and Mayan cultures, you know, they have bat gods, and so they've known about vampire bats. But for white people, when they showed up, the vampire bat only got described in like 1809 or 1810 or something like that. So then they got a whole bunch of specimens. They've got skulls now that are, you know, over 200 years old. And there's stories of museum curators carelessly holding these vampire skulls, vampire bat skulls, and cutting themselves. Because their teeth are so sharp, even after 200 years, they're still slicing their hands open because they're mishandling a vampire bat skull. So that gives you an idea of just how sharp these teeth are.
That is, yeah, that's crazy. So, and like, that makes sense as well, though, with it being like a tiny little pinprick of, like, for it to be there for 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you just, I can't imagine, because how big are these bats anyway?
It's about, I want to say it's about 40 grams. Might be a little bit less than that, but they're way nastier and stronger when you have them in hand. So when I've caught them and I've had them in hand, and you look at an animal. So for the listeners at home, like, it's about the size, just about the size of a pop can, like a soda can, right, if you were holding it, right? And so you look at an animal that's 40 grams or so, and you're like, oh, okay, you're about this strong, but it is so much stronger.
Really?
So because Ruby was talking about, you know, they're on the ground, and so they're one of the most terrestrial bats. We were actually putting them on treadmills, and so there's some really great videos. If you go to YouTube, you might actually see my hand running one of these treadmills. Anyway, so they're super terrestrial. They're on the ground. They're biting the cow. They've got their meal, and then they have to fly away. And the way they do that is they use their arms and they do like a push-up position.
Yes.
And, you know, that's how they create their lift.
Yes.
So imagine you've got a 40-gram animal, but it's basically just gymming every day, just chest.
Totally.
It's just bench press.
I feel like I've seen photos of it do that. I know what you mean.
Yeah. Yep. And so it's just it's super strong.
Whoa, that's freaky. So if it actually, I was going to ask, there have been a few cases of them biting humans, but I assume that that's accidental?
It's very rare. Very rare.
Like, they don't seem like they'd be that interested in us. Too much work.
No, I mean, like, we're not a good prey item. You know, if you want to sneak up on us, you know, we're usually inside a house or something like that, whereas a cow is going to be, you know, out in the wild, you know,
free range.
But the important thing with that is that, you know, if there are what we call, you know, human-animal conflicts like this, and vampire bats, particularly in Central and South America, are oftentimes villainized, right?
Mm-hmm.
There might be the spread of rabies between people's livestock and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But you had asked earlier, you know, do they get a bad rap? And certainly they do, right, because of this.
Totally.
But it's not the animal's fault that we then have cleared the forest that they would be living in.
Exactly.
And so by us encroaching on them, that's what drives this kind of human-animal conflict.
Yeah.
And that's very common in other bats. You know, in Africa, you've got the Ebola virus, which was, you know, very concretely thought to be transmission from bats to humans. But once again, bats and humans would never have been that close had we not cleared that forest. So
that's
an important thing.
Exactly. It's reminding me of that film Contagion.
Which was one of the other, because I think you guys did that
we
one.
Did Syphilis,
and that, that was going to be one of the ones that I was going to put out there. But,
right. Already done. But that's like when they're obviously working out patient zero and all of that, it's like goes back, there's the pig and then there's the bat. And it was just, obviously, like you say, it's kind of something that has been almost like provoked, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's our fault.
Yeah, right?
You know
it's
what I mean.
Fault.
If you clear the forest where they're living, and you put a pig stable in there, for example, so now there might be 100 bats that are living in a hectare.
Yeah.
And now they're living in 0.1 of a hectare, and they're all in this pig stable.
Yeah,
you see what I'm saying? Like, that's the density of the animals. So without boring your listeners into into how we
Go
get
on.
Into. Wildlife conflict, like, this is one of the big issues. And
absolutely, I agree. I mean, obviously, we can talk about the bad rap for poor vampire bats, but like
bats in general, and I think through human history, that's been one of the things, you know, because they're out at night, you know, they're so mysterious. In general, I think humans don't really like things at night because it's historically when we've been most vulnerable. If you think of the evolutionary history of human beings, you know, nighttime is probably the most dangerous time.
Yeah,
and if
exactly.
you've got animals that are, you know, predominantly active during the night, then it makes sense that, you know, they get villainized.
Yeah, we're a little bit unsure and suspicious. Going back to the bat I had in my house.
Yes.
Obviously, you know, I'd like to know how someone might, like, do something about that, because in the film, we're seeing all these, you know, vampires who then are bats, and then vice versa, getting destroyed using wooden stakes. It's not nice. I want to know how am I meant to get rid of a bat in my house? Because what happened, I'm pretty sure it was in like a vent, and then it's come out, and then it's just like circling, and it was tiny. It was very cute, but like I have no idea. So I had to basically just like open doors and hope that it would come out eventually.
Yep.
Like I'm not meant to touch them, right? Like...
Ruby, you can take this one.
So, yes, it would be ill-advised for anyone to try and catch a bat.
Don't touch the bats.
Right.
Yes.
Great.
So don't touch the bats. You know. I mean, that should be, you know, the general operative condition for any wildlife.
That can be our takeaway today.
Surely. So what you can do is, so if you've got the bat in, say, your living room, so if you can... like open the doors and windows that lead to your garden,
yes,
and close the doors that go into your other sections of your house, and then you can sort of, you know, funnel the bat towards your door or window using a, you know, large, you know, bed sheet, a large towel, you know, because they wouldn't want to, you know, try and go through that. So you can sort of, you know, herd it,
exactly,
for want of a better word, towards, you know, that opening, and you know, that should allow it to leave your house.
It was so cute. I imagine there must have been like quite a few hanging out in that
old
house. Yeah.
It probably just got lost, and then as Ruby's saying, you know, and as we are adamant, don't touch the bat, because although there is no rabies in Australia, there is Australian bat lysivirus, which is a type of rabies.
Right.
And so if Yeah, it's just stay away from them. Don't touch them. You can call pest control, and they'll come. You can call other services, and that's probably, if you open the doors, you open the windows, and it doesn't leave, then at that point call someone who's vaccinated against it, because, you know, if you get scratched or if you get bitten, then you definitely have to go and get post-exposure vaccines. And
really?
That's not a lot of fun.
That's not fun? Okay.
And the other thing, too, is, you know, we'd want to make sure that we tell the people that, you know, don't try to hurt the animal, you know what I mean?
Obviously.
Because obviously it's hard, though, you know, and a lot of people, you know, have these, you know, feelings and attitudes towards bats because they just don't know about them, right? But
sure.
Ruby was talking before, you know, these animals are potentially eating their entire body weight in insects every night. So if you have a 10-gram animal, right, that means it's eating 10 grams of insects every night. And then if you have colony of them, let's say 100 animals, that's a kilogram of insects that they're removing from around your house every night.
Yep.
So
yeah,
definitely beneficial in that
sense. Yeah. I mean, it would have been great if I could have just let it hang out, but it looked terrified. It was freaking out. So, yeah, that's a shame. But I'm sure it was doing a lot of hard work, you know.
Guaranteed it was doing
a lot
of hard
work. That house did not have any fly screens or anything. So, it was useful.
Right.
Okay, so... Have you guys watched the film recently? Like, have you rewatched it?
No, I haven't.
You ever seen it? Okay.
I watched it when I was in high school, having no idea what was going to happen, and it was one of the best experiences I've ever had watching a movie.
Oh, that's so cool!
Because it just the midway turn.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So, okay, into the second act, third act. Oh, this is a completely different movie. I don't want to spoil it. I mean, for those.
Sure.
Well,
it's 1996.
I mean, yeah, you should have seen it by now, right?
But yeah, it's. I think I read that a lot of people didn't know, you know, going into the cinema, like that it was a vampire film.
Yeah.
So obviously, yeah, that like midway point where things turn crazy would be so fun. But yeah, like I think the film obviously took a lot of liberties. It's a wild film, but I was impressed that you know, it's set in Mexico. It's set at the border, which is obviously where the vampire bat is apparently commonly chilling out.
Yeah.
So you know, that's one tick. Right.
Yep. That was one of the reasons I chose it, because
Yay.
It's like, for, you know, for a vampire film, like it actually happens in Central and South America,
yes.
Which was where the animals are.
Yes.
It has George Clooney, who then the next year plays Batman.
Oh, so. That's such an interesting thread. I wonder if he felt influenced. But he's also just, like, lovely to watch. So thanks for that.
Particularly late 90s, George. I mean,
yeah,
come on.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent choice. But, yeah, aside from that, I think it just goes crazier. It's written by Tarantino, so he was just having fun. But I was just going to ask, are there any particular species outside of Australia that you'd be interested in checking out? However, you guys have been checking them out everywhere. So is there anything left? Like, yeah.
Ruby, you take that one, mate.
Yeah. So, definitely quite a few on my list. Again, thanks to Zen, as I said, last year we were in Canada, and I got to actually capture and handle what's called a spotted bat. So this is one of the rarest bats in North America. So there are very few sort of capture records of this bat. And just to give you an idea of how rare this bat is, so we were working with a group of bat scientists, and some of them had been doing, you know, bat work since even before I was born. And then we catch this bat, and they lost it.
There were some tears.
Yes, there were some tears shed.
I'm sure.
People were high-fiving each other. They were just going bonkers.
Totally.
And I didn't realize how rare this bat was. So I asked one of these scientists, like I said, right, I know it's rare, but is it actually this rare? And then she goes, this is a unicorn.
Those
were her exact words. So and I was there, and I've handled a spotted bat. So yes, that's a big
very
win.
Cool.
But yeah, you know, and you know, there are some extremely cute bats, you know, around the world. Like if you look at the Honduran white bat,
Ectophila alba. For those of you who speak Latin.
So it's basically, think of a little ball of cotton wool. You know, that's what it looks like. You know, it's just pure white with yellow, you know, ears and a yellow mouth. It's just absolutely
so cute.
It makes tents, so it hangs out with its friends, and it gets the big, imagine like a banana leaf.
Yes.
And so it cuts along the main vein of the leaf and folds it down. And so as you're walking through the forest, you look up underneath one of these leaves, and there's just a bunch of tiny little cotton balls. They're white, yeah. It's awesome.
That's so cute.
A very cool bat.
Okay, wow, yeah. Yeah, I mean, how many did you say, 1,500?
1,500, and yeah. I mean, so that's... So do you have a hit list, Ruby, like the ones that you want to see?
Yeah, so, you know, you've got the Honduran white bat. I would love to see the greater pied butterfly bat from Central and West Africa.
Is that the orange and black one?
The white and... black.
Oh, the badger
bat.
Cute.
And, very cute.
Yeah. And then, of course, Vampirum, the Greater Falls Vampire Bat.
Vampirum Spectrum?
The Spectrum.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is a monstrous.
It eats frogs.
It is so cool.
It's the biggest bat in the New World, and it looks gnarly. And it's for those... Okay, so... That bat is closely related, or at least it looks like one of the bats here. My favorite bat in Australia that I haven't seen or touched yet is called the ghost bat. It lives up north the Northern Territory. It's white, and it lives in these hot caves, and it eats birds and frogs and little marsupials if it can get its face on them, and other bats.
Whoa.
And so, yeah, and so they've done these experiments where they have bats in their roosts, and then they play the echolocation calls of the ghost bat, and the bats don't come out of their roosts. So they know that it's like, oh man, there is something out there that's going to eat me right now.
Oh my god, that's terrifying.
Macroderma gigas.
Okay,
I'll
be looking that up later.
it's pretty gnarly. Yeah, it looks like in Donnie Darko, when the rabbit, the weird rabbit thing, it kind of looks like that. That's what it reminds me of.
Okay, that's way freakier now. I'll be looking that up, and then I'll be regretting it. You actually put up something, Ruby, on your socials the other day of a vampire bat, didn't you?
I think you're referring to the lesser false vampire bat. So this is another species of bat that we have back home in Sri Lanka.
Yeah.
So it's Megaderma spasma, the false vampire bats. So again, incredibly cool looking bats with these gigantic ears and lovely, you know, nose leaves. So exceptional sense of hearing, you know, as the massive ears suggest. So, you know, locating prey by echolocation and all of that. So yes, extremely unreal. Cool bats.
Yeah.
Yes.
Was that your photo?
Yes, that was.
Wow, that's amazing.
Thank you.
All right, so outside of vampires, obviously we've got Batman on one spectrum, and then we've got Dracula at the other. Mm-hmm. What would you guys like to see in terms of, you know, film representation of something to do with bats that can we, like, fill this representational gap? You know, not a superhero, not a bad guy. Like, can we do anything?
I think there's a lot of really good, so potentially in a, you know, Hollywood blockbuster, maybe not, but there's a lot of really good documentaries that, you know, explore how important these animals can be in ecosystem services.
Yeah.
So that's I think really neat.
Cool. I wonder if you know any. I'll have to look some up.
Yeah, I think if you put in, I mean, even if your starting point is like Attenborough and then bats,
of course.
I mean, Sir David's got some really cool things. There's some, I know, so in one of my classes, I use videos of what's called a fishing bat or a greater bulldog bat. And it fishes, basically. So imagine, you know, most insectivorous bats are using echolocation to find the insects. So they're creating echoes, and then the bounce of that echo, the echo, tells the animal where it is, right? And fishing bats actually use the bubbles that are coming up from the water, and they can identify that there's a fish underneath there, and then they've got these long, long feet with big claws, and they scoop up fish that way. So there's a really cool bit on that in terms of, like, you know, natural history documentaries.
Absolutely.
In popular culture, so in Canada, there's a book called Silver Wing that we read when we were little, which is about a bat and its family and whatnot.
Is there a bat in Fern Gully?
Yes, there is. Yeah he's crazy. He
seems kind of cool, though.
Yeah, he's I can't remember what his name is, though.
Me either, but I
maybe in the
him
Great
being...
Mouse Detective, there's one as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I know the one you mean.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's some cool little dudes in there.
Yeah, there is.
Okay, awesome. And when people come to watch the film, you know, in a couple of weeks, is there anything you'd like them to look out for or just keep in mind when they're watching it?
Okay, so listen, I would hope that the audience just kind of turns their brain off. The movie doesn't take itself too seriously, and I don't think you're going to find any nuggets about bat biology in there that are worth taking home.
It's a good kickstart, you
fun.
Know? Yeah, it's so much fun. I can't wait. I'm so excited. Okay, so we'll wrap it up there. Thanks so much for coming in and chatting and teaching
my
me all
pleasure.
The stuff and answering my, like, very basic questions about bats. I appreciate it. I'll see you both on May 2nd at 6 p.m. I'll see everyone there at 6 p.m. May 2nd. Tickets are already at Belgrave, so go get them. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Bridget.
Thanks,
guys.